This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. On today's show, a Cincinnati police officer sues the city manager. The Hamilton County and Cincinnati Public Library asks for more funding. Westwood's population is on the rise as more people discover the neighborhood's many charms. And Oktoberfest Cincinnati is this weekend. It's our weekly news review. And first up, the country responds to Hurricane Irma. WCPO.com investigative reporter Hillary Lake was in Florida to report on the damage and the recovery efforts. She joins us now. Hi, Hillary. Good afternoon.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
So what did you see? What kind of damage happened? You were in Naples, is that correct?
I was in Naples. That was my second stop. I was there from last Thursday until this Tuesday. So we got there a couple of days before the storm hit, and we were able to see people making preparations and whatnot. First stop was on the Treasure Coast, on the east coast of Florida. West Palm went up north of that to Stewart. That day, when we got there on Thursday, the storm was tracking in that direction. By Saturday, the storm had moved back to the west coast, so I got a call from my boss. He said, you need to get in the car and drive across the state to Naples. And there, it was just more of the same. You know, people just preparing, hanging up shutters, making sure that all of their things were off their patios and in their house, and then leaving, even some last-minute evacuations. But when the storm came through on Sunday, it was Sunday afternoon, Sunday morning, late Sunday morning, it was a Category 3. Those are winds of 129 miles an hour.
Nothing to sneeze at.
No. Nothing to sneeze at, yeah. For sure. That is still a major hurricane, even though it's not the Cat 4 that was initially predicted. You know, we watched it. We were inside of a building that was rated to take a Cat 4. So we were able to look out the windows and watch as the worst part came through. And there were trees just bending over sideways. There were palm fronds ripping off the palm trees and blowing down the street. But it wasn't until all of it was over and the flooding started and we could go outside and see that there was a semi-truck that was flipped over. There was definitely some damage to some homes, apartment buildings, but just trees down everywhere. Some of the roads were impassable because there were so many trees and power lines down.
You know, as Floridians, have they become somewhat used to this? I mean, do they have kind of a different attitude toward the storms?
You know, I think that's the case. I heard several people say, you know, this is just part of what comes with living here. This is part of this lifestyle. We expect these hurricanes. Most people evacuated. From what we could tell, most people evacuated. And I think had Harvey not happened so close to Irma, even though it's in a different state, we might have seen more people sticking around, but most people got out. The people who stuck around were the people who had been through this 3, 4, 5 times before and knew that their places were safe or the safest place for them to be.
Yeah, even after the storm, how difficult was it for people to get back to their homes?
It was tough. You know, our crews went out as soon as we could, as soon as it was safe Sunday night. We went out and started surveying the damage. And of course, by then it was dark. So, you know, we were able to tell that yeah, there were trees down and that a lot of neighborhoods were inaccessible because of that. When we were able to go back out Monday morning when the sun came up, it was more of the same. And, you know, people who had gone to shelters or who had, you know, left and then tried to come back that night to their properties Monday morning. There were instances where we encountered people and we said, hey, you know, you're not going to be able to get through. A photographer that I was working with, he, in one of the neighborhoods where we were, he walked into it just to see if homes and condos were damaged. And he said, I didn't see a lot of damaged buildings, but there are three entrances to this neighborhood and all three of them were blocked with giant trees and in some case flooding. And, you know, when you're gone from your home, your first instinct is going to be, I want to go back and check out my property.
Right. I want to see what happened. Yeah.
And that these people were determined to get in there and do that, even though we told them repeatedly, you can't get through without a chainsaw. So people would go past us and then they would have to turn around and come back and say, yeah, we should have listened to you guys. But I understand, yeah. You know, that
sure.
would be my first instinct, too. I would want to check out my property.
If I can get to my house, I'd want to
sure.
see what happened to my
yeah.
house. Do we know how many homes were destroyed by this?
I can't give you a solid count. I mean, I would say across Florida, of course, the Keys were hit possibly the worst. The Keys and Marco Island, those were the two landfall places. And that's where, you know, if you've seen pictures on TV or the web of just the what looks like widespread devastation, that's where those pictures are most likely coming from. I've drove across the state twice, actually. And I can tell you that it really is pockets. Any old mobile homes are probably flattened at this point. But other homes, especially homes that were built after Hurricane Andrew, after some of the other hurricanes where building codes were made to be much more greater than they were when those hurricanes came around, buildings are still there. So sure, you can drive through just about any city on the coasts of Florida and find some damage. But it's not widespread. It's not like all of Florida got wiped out.
What about loss of life? Injuries from this?
The latest count I heard, I believe it's more than 30 people, and I believe that also includes the eight people who died in a nursing home after the storm hit because they were not evacuated. They lost their power. They didn't have air conditioning. So they died afterwards. It's very sad.
But how many people from Cincinnati, how many different organizations went down to help with the relief effort?
Oh, geez. Well, I believe we've had Matthew 25, and I know the Red Cross sent some people down down there, and I don't recall if Ohio's task force got sent. I know that they were on standby to go back after they came back from Harvey, and they may have also sent a few people. But yeah, there's response coming now from all across the country.
How is the relief effort going? What did you observe?
Well, what we observed was, you know, power trucks were there prior to the storm even coming from across the country, just sort of waiting outside of places to go in. So there was a great response for power companies, utility companies to go in and start making those repairs right away. But, you know, the loss of power really statewide was just remarkable. I mean, we were seeing hundreds of thousands of customers without power. These are numbers that I've never seen before when it comes to power outages. And even some of the power companies down there were saying, we've never seen outage numbers
really
like this before either. Yeah. Yeah. But in terms of other responses there, you know, the Salvation Army that is there, the Red Cross is there, churches are stepping up. You know, we were even seeing in some cases restaurants that either had generator power, so they were able to save some of their food, opening up the day after, cooking free meals for people who needed food. And so when you see stuff like that, it reminds you of just how great we are as humans and how well we can treat each other when it comes down to it.
Did you see a lot of neighbor helping neighbor type situations?
You know, I didn't see neighbors necessarily walking in with chainsaws to help other neighbors. But what I did see was, hey, how are you doing? Are you doing okay? Is there anything I can help you with? Or, you know, just people coming out of their homes who had hunkered down in their homes for the first time and encountering another neighbor on the street, just talking to each other about what it felt like to ride out the storm and, you know, how are you doing? And I thought that was really great to see. Another thing, and I think this just goes to show you sort of the mentality of a lot of people in Florida right now. Usually in my past experience of covering things like wildfires and, you know, blizzards and things like that, or just any horrible, horrible story, sometimes you have people get very emotional. They see the media. They don't want the media there. They yell at us sometimes, and that's just what comes with it. And I understand that because these are very emotional times. In the 6 days I was in Florida, I did not have one person yell at me or express anger that the media was there. In fact, a lot of people were thanking us for being there.
They were glad to see you there.
For sharing their stories, yeah, and letting people know that, hey, we're going to be okay, and hey, we are okay.
So when you talk to people who lived on there, who experienced serious home damage, did you get a sense from them? Are most of these people planning to rebuild, or are they talking about moving out of the area? Or?
Yeah, no, a lot of people are. This is the way of life. They're in Florida for a reason. If they have damage, they're going to fix the damage and they're going to carry on with life because they love living there. And for me, this was the first hurricane that I've ever gone through, that I've ever seen. I don't know that I could say that, but you know, I think if you've lived in that place for a long time and you're committed to living there and you enjoy living there for the rest of the time, sure, you're going to rebuild. You're going
to
stay.
Did most of the people you talked to seem to have a sense of optimism that everything was going to work out in the end?
Oh, yeah. Even in places where there was damage. You know, of course, the folks who had severe damage to their homes, mobile homes and whatnot, in talking with some of the other reporters that I was with, of course, there were, you know, questions of how am I going to rebuild? Am I going to stay here? But in the end, it really comes down to that's where you live. That's where you're from. So you're going to find a way to make it, whether it's finding a way on your own or reaching out to people or people reaching out to you to help you get what you need to rebuild.
So what do you take away from seeing all this?
You know, Florida is a very resilient state. The people of Florida are very, very resilient. And I think that I heard time and time again that, and I'm going to quote people here, this could have been so much worse. And that could have just been because of where we were. We were not down in the Keys. And I know, like I said, that the Keys were just, in some parts, just flattened. And that is very, very tragic to see. But I have no doubt that even the people who were hit the hardest, they're going to rebuild and they're going to be okay. But that doesn't mean that they don't need our help, that they don't need help from people outside of the area. They're going to need help for a very, very long time, whether it's bottled water or food or even help rebuilding, because that's just how bad some of it is.
What do you say is the greatest need? Is it water at this point?
I don't know necessarily what the greatest need is. I know that things like when you go to get supplies from certain places, you can't get diapers in some places. You can't get feminine hygiene products in some places. And so things like that are needed. Water can always be used. A lot of places are still under a boil water notice. So you can't drink the water. They don't even want you to touch the water. And I know in where we were in Collier County, they're telling people now, if you have water, conserve it. We don't want you to be using it because it's not on in all of the places. And there could come a point when it's just not there anymore until they get things fixed. So, you know, there are lots of places to donate, the Red Cross, the Salvation Army. And I think by now, by going online, you can find other places. I know in Texas, they have a diaper bank where you can donate to. And I believe there's something like that in Florida as well, so that folks who need to get diapers for their kids can.
But I think it's going to be a long road to recovery for these
folks.
This
is not going to be something that, you know, 1, 2, 3 weeks from now. This is going to be months in some cases, maybe even a year or longer, just depending on how bad the damage is. And, you know, you've got – it's not just wind damage either. You have flooding. And after that, we're already seeing, with Harvey anyway, mold. So that's going to happen in Florida. You've got mold that's going to develop in some places, and that just sort of adds insult to injury.
Yeah.
So, you know, this is not going to be a quick recovery by any means.
Hillary, thank you so much for joining me this afternoon.
Thanks for having me.
WCPO.com investigative reporter Hillary Lake. Coming up, a look at hate crimes in our region. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. Joining us now, Inquirer investigative reporter James Pilcher, who's been looking into hate crimes in our region. You can join us at 513-419-7100. You can email talk at wvxu.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. And good afternoon, James.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. James, as you're looking at this, as you're doing this story, what did you find? What's the extent of hate crimes in our region, and what is fueling this?
Well, part of the point of the story was that we really don't know, that a lot of crimes, so to speak, aren't reported as quote-unquote hate crimes. I mean, hate crimes is a very specific legal term, and it has to meet a certain criteria to be prosecuted as such on the federal level. And then the different states have different varying either definitions or penalties for such crimes. Usually it is because of a person's race, color, you know, sexual orientation, those kinds of things. But what I found both here and when I talked to experts nationally is that those kinds of crimes are going underreported. Because usually they're dealt with as normal crimes and not reported as bias-based crimes, and that there are some that don't quite fall into that category, but they're being fueled by extremist views. For example, the lead example I use in the story is that there were three men in Boone County about 4 years ago kidnapped, tortured, and killed, and then dismembered another white man. And at the time, it was just kind of, you know, gone forward and even presented to some in the media as a drug deal gone bad, or they didn't like this drug dealer. Well, as it turns out, two of the three were actually avowed followers of the National Socialist Movement, a well-known white supremacist group, and they had very very vowed followers of Nazism. They had Nazi tattoos. They even said on websites they like to read Adolf Hitler and other Nazi leaders' works. So, and part of that group's mission is to rid the world of the ruthless prosecution of all criminals, including drug dealers, pedophiles, etc. So their goal was to torture this guy and find out where his bosses were, where his dealers were, and then go after them. And on this particular night, things got out of hand, and they wound up killing him. But that was actually listed. It was not reported as a hate crime, and in Kentucky, you can only call it a hate crime after prosecution for sentencing reasons. And so it was never really registered as a hate crime, but it pops up on a government database as being an example of extremist violence because it was clearly fueled by extremist political views. So, you know, it's hard to really pinpoint. And another expert said to me that, you know, there are maybe 25,000 to 50,000 reported hate crimes in the country or prosecuted hate crimes, but then the actual victims' reports state that over 250,000 crimes nationally were based on some kind of bias, whether it be racial or otherwise. So I think that, you know, the events of Charlottesville, which kind of sparked our story, our look at this, and our continued look at this, this won't be the first story we do on these kinds of things, was that, you know, there's going to be a lot more attention brought to it, and actually law enforcement is struggling both at the federal, state, and local level with how to categorize this. I had an interview with the local U.S. attorney who said, you know, part of the problem is that there's not really a domestic terrorism statute. There's clearly a statute for aiding and abetting and even carrying out foreign terrorist groups, but there isn't anything for domestic terrorism, and it is not against the law to be a neo-Nazi, to hold those views because of the First Amendment. If you think or say that, you have every right in the world to do that. It's when you act out on it, and then they have to just prosecute you as, you know, a normal criminal. So it's really become a conundrum for law enforcement.
James, under hate crime laws, let's take Kentucky's as an example. Are the penalties tougher because it's classified as a hate crime?
Not in Kentucky. Kentucky's actually, this came up about 13 years ago. Kentucky's is considered one of the worst and lenient in the country. And there was some controversy. I'll get into that in a minute over that law, which was amended just last year, or earlier this year. But in Kentucky, you can only call it a hate crime after the person is convicted in a jury trial and you go to the sentencing phase. And that's when the prosecutor can get up and say, hey, we think this was a hate crime and here's why. And the only thing it does is it affects when that person can get paroled or get probation. So, it, you know, you can't, you know, convict somebody of a hate crime in Kentucky. You can only have it affect their sentencing. And it doesn't add any more years to your sentence. It only can add to when you might go be eligible for parole. Ohio's is a little tougher, and there is an actual hate crime statute on the books in Ohio, but I think it's, you know, it has to be in addition to another crime. And on the state level, I mean, on the federal level, you can get up to 10 to 20 years for these. But the prosecution has been spotty. I also highlight another case involving, this was pretty well publicized at the time, but last fall, a former tenant of this couple's house in West Price Hill completely trashed the place, but also painted racial epithets, swastikas, white power, and even threats all over the wall. And the U.S. attorney stepped in and has prosecuted under the federal hate crimes laws. And that's actually the first federal prosecution of a hate crime on the federal level in 20 years in our area. So, you know, there have been a couple in Kentucky because they've actually had to turn to the federal prosecutors because there is no state hate crime law. There was a cross burning in Boone County in 2004 where the local prosecutor who actually also prosecuted the murder we talked about had to turn to the feds and say, hey, I can't do anything about this. They're going to get a misdemeanor vandalism charge, and that's it, even though they ran this black couple or this black family out of town. So the federal prosecutor stepped in, and the guys were found guilty and got like 3 years in federal prison.
So in the case of Northern Kentucky native James Field Jr., who's accused of killing a woman by driving his car into a crowd in Charlottesville, is it fair to say that, that's not an anomaly?
Well, such public ones are pretty much an anomaly. But what we found and what I found through research is that, and that there's got lots of government reports backing this up, that almost on a 2-to-1 margin, any extremist acts or plots are, you know, I don't know what you want to categorize them, white supremacists, far-right, alt-right, whatever. You know, people are arguing with me after this story over the terminology of this, but, you know, I think we all know kind of that group. And like I said, almost on a 2-to-1 margin, those are those groups versus Islamic groups. And even the FBI has said multiple times over the last decade that the greatest threat is coming from, at least in the United States, is coming from domestic terrorism as opposed to international terrorism. But quantifying that, and that was something else we touched upon in the story, is more difficult because even in one of the reports I cited, the governmental accounting office, you know, called the Department of Justice to task, saying you have no way to measure. You're not measuring this. You're not keeping track of whether your efforts are working or not. So, you know, that's a big gap in this, is that we don't really know. We do know that the ones that have happened around here that we do know about, that we can categorize as such, as extremist, politically extremist acts or plots throughout Ohio, have been more, even though the Islamic ones have gotten more attention, there have been more from the alt-right slash white supremacists.
So is there an effort underway, James, to improve the tracking and reporting of hate crimes and to...
Not that I've seen, no. Not that I was able to report. And like I said, that report from the government to Congress just came out in May. So I really don't know, especially with the new Justice Department and what they're... they've clearly said international terrorism is now our number one priority. They've said that in the past since Jeff Sessions took over. So I think I really can't tell whether or not they're trying any harder to track this. I can tell you that there are active investigations into James Fields' background by federal agents here in the area and in Charlottesville to determine whether or not they can bring federal charges, federal hate crime charges in that murder case involving his car.
So are you planning to do any follow-up on this story, James?
Yes. We are continuing to look at, you know, the sources of these groups, where these people from our area come to believe these things, and, you know, see if we can just expose it and explain it to people and say, hey, this is here, and here's how it's happening, and let the public know that it's out there. That's our next steps.
Well, James, thank you for joining us this afternoon.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
Enquirer investigative reporter James Pilcher. Coming up next, what's behind the resurgence in Westwood? This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. It's our weekly review of local news. Joining us now, WCPO multimedia journalist Evan Millward, WCPO economic development reporter Bob Driehaus, and Enquirer City Hall reporter Cameron Knight. And Evan, Bob, and Cameron, thanks for being here this afternoon. Good to see everybody.
Thanks.
Happy to be here.
Bob, let's talk about Westwood. Now, if I understand right, this is not the first time you've written about a resurgence in Westwood, but this is the first time you say you've actually seen some evidence of this.
Yeah. And I think 2004, I actually wrote for Cincinnati Magazine a story where they brought the Guardian Angels in from New York. And, you know, we looked for all the light at the end of the tunnel then. I think it was, in hindsight, premature. You know, housing prices continued to suffer back for the next 10 years or more. But this time, you're really seeing housing prices going up significantly, a lot of development around Westwood Town Hall, and some real concrete evidence that things are on the rise.
Yeah. How much have housing prices gone up in Westwood?
They've nearly doubled in 5 years. I asked MLS, the folks who keep track of these things, for the whole neighborhood's prices. And yeah, it's just under double from 5 years ago.
So home prices have doubled. What about population? What's happened with the population? And
So we don't have firm statistics on that. We won't till 2020. But the zip code, according to the census, it's estimated that it's gone up by almost 2,000. And that's most 45211 is mostly Westwood, and it's on the rise.
So you're looking at the stats here. What are the people in Westwood saying? Are they actually seeing this happen?
Definitely. That's where this story started. I got a walk through the neighborhood with John Eby a few months ago, and he was showing me the new businesses coming up, the Westside Brewing. There was a lot of excitement around that, the craft brewery, Muse Cafe opening. And John and Larry Iser, two guys who've been very involved with neighborhood associations there, they've both been saying we see a lot of young families coming up, some folks who have been living in over the Rhine or Northside or Clifton and are ready to go have something a little more suburban without being way out in the suburbs. So that's where the story started, and I found some of those folks, young couples, young people coming up from different neighborhoods, and it turned out to really bear out.
Now, where is the growth most evident in Westwood? Where is most of this happening?
I think it's mostly around the old center. Westwood was a village in the 1800s before it became part of Cincinnati. So you've got some gorgeous old buildings from the late 1800s, early 1900s, centered around Harrison Avenue, Erweiler, Daytona, Montana, around Westwood Town Hall. So those are the areas with just great housing stock that people have, you know, really been drawn toward.
Yeah. What are some of the things Westwood has going for it in terms of amenities that they're attracting people?
Yeah. Well, the geography has not changed. It's still super close to downtown and UC. So some of the couples I talk to either work downtown or at UC. You're talking less than 15-minute drive to either of those areas. They've been working hard at revitalizing the business district along Harrison Avenue. So the city's putting about $4 million into revitalizing around Town Hall, and that has drawn some private business in, like Westside Brewing. Madcap Puppet is taking over this beautiful old Cincinnati Bell building with a lot of help. Muse Cafe. So they've got a second Saturday festival going on in those blocks where they block it off to traffic and just have a big party. I've driven by a couple times on the way to putting my kids to bed, but it looks hopping each time I see it.
Yeah. Is diversity a strength for Westwood?
They absolutely say yes. I said in that story when I grew up there, and the circles I were in were very Catholic, very white, and it was almost homogenous in that way, at least at the places I interacted. And there's still a great, strong St. Catherine's Parish there, a lot of those families still around. But these days, it's more than half of residents are African American, just a little under half are white. And the folks that I talk to who live there, they really value that. They think that they want to be in a neighborhood that where everybody doesn't look like them, where there's real diversity. I talked to a woman who said real diversity doesn't mean everybody is of one race or the other. It's not a buzzword for an African American neighborhood, nor is it for any other one race. They really value being not sticking out like a sore thumb in any given, you know, ethnicity.
You think what's going on in Westwood bodes well for other neighborhoods?
Definitely. I've been covering development as a beat now all year, and it's just blown me away to see all these old neighborhoods, not all of them, but many of them, you're just seeing a great resurgence with lots of new people, lots of new businesses, whether it's College Hill, Walnut Hills, East Walnut Hills, to some degree, Price Hill. So there's been a lot of revitalization of the older urban core.
Yeah, and as you're doing this story, what do you think are the prospects for Westwood's future?
Well, I mean, as long as the economy keeps expanding, I don't see any reason why this won't continue. There are a lot of great houses. While prices have doubled or almost doubled, the median house price is still like $90,000.
Still an affordable neighborhood.
Absolutely. Yeah. So there's a lot of upside left for them.
Yeah. Cameron, the library board wants to ask voters to raise the library tax. They're asking for more revenue here. So what's the story here? How much are they asking for and what's going on?
Well, this whole story actually started several months ago with an intern of ours named Mariel Padilla, and she actually just kind of was poking around the library and discovered that they have this large building plan that they want to do, and they also have decided to pull out of the north building of the main library downtown. The north building was built after it was an addition to the main library campus, and it was built about 20 years ago at a cost of a little under $40 million. And when we discovered that, people started getting really upset about it. They want that space, at least a certain faction of people really want that space to remain public. And they're scared that it's going to be sold off to developers, and they really want it to remain public. As part of that, I just started asking a lot of questions of the library and the library board. And part of that is that they say that the reason they want to pull out of this to maybe get a little more money is so that they can because they're facing decreasing state funding. They're facing some different funding challenges around the library system. And as part of these questions I was asking them, I kind of just surveyed them and said, well, what about increasing the levy? At this point in time, they do have a levy that was put in place around 2009-ish. And
it was pretty heavily supported.
It was very heavily supported.
It was like over 70%, if I remember
right. Yeah, over 70% supported the library. They did a very successful campaign. They've since renewed it kind of early. They decided to try to renew it a little bit early. So that was successful as well. And but just in this kind of set of questions, I asked all of the library board members. They all support an increase to that levy. And it's not up for renewal until actually the next decade. It's in the 2020s is when it's actually up for renewal. But the interesting thing about the library board is unlike a lot of other levies, the library board controls all of it. So they can set the millage, they can set when it goes up, they can do all of that without the Hamilton County Board of Commissioners approving it or anything like that. So they kind of have this special tax district where they kind of decide all the stuff about the levy, and it doesn't really go through another check before it hits the voters. So when all of the members of the board say, yeah, we probably need more levy money, that's a pretty strong indication that they're gonna ask for more.
So they've got the authority to ask for this before the renewal in 2024.
Correct.
Okay.
Yeah, they can ask for it as early as next year. It would be too late to get it on the ballot this year, obviously. So they could ask for it as early as next year. They could ask for it in whenever they want. And that the amount of increase is also completely up to the board. It's not this year, for instance, we have like a senior services levy, and that goes through this tax levy review committee. It goes through several meetings with the county commissioners. The commissioners have to vote on what the, you know, if there's going to be an increase, what it's going to be, where that money is going to go, all of this kind of stuff. There isn't a lot of that for the library board. The commissioners don't have any control over what the library wants to do with their levy. They have control over it inside the board.
But at this point, we don't know how much they'd like to raise this. They just know that they want to raise it.
Right. They all indicated that they feel like they need more levy money.
Now, how much of the revenue that goes to the library, how much of it's local, how much of it is from the state?
Well, that's it's an interesting kind of look at it, because the local money, the property tax money, brings in about a little over 20% of their total revenue stream. And another from the state brings in, I think, a little over 40% of their money comes from the state. And or actually significantly more than that, I think. But it's a large portion of their money comes from the state. And that's unique to Ohio. Almost every other state in the country does not have their libraries funded through the state. And that dates way back to the 1930s. I talked to the Ohio Library Council, and they explained that that's sort of why Ohio libraries are special is because they get state funding, and we get a lot of state funding compared to other library systems. We get more state funding than Columbus. We get more state funding than Cleveland because we're a countywide system, whereas in Columbus, they have a county system. They have a metro system. In Cleveland, they have a county system, a metro system. So because we're a big combined system, we get a lot of money. About 10% of all the state library funding, so all the money that is set aside for libraries in Ohio, about 10% of it comes to straight to Cincinnati.
But it's had a big impact, right? I mean, I think Cincinnati's what, third in size?
For sure. We have great libraries. Of the top 10 libraries as ranked by the Library Journal, which is a national kind of ranking, they have a star system and a scoring system. The Library Journal says, like, I think more than, I think, like, four or five of our of Ohio's libraries are in the top of the country. So we're right up there with New York. We're right up there with Seattle. We're right up there with some pretty big places.
So we know they want to do it. Is there a sense of when they'll make a decision on? Nope.
There's no sense. They meet six times a year, which is, according to some people, a little bit different than some big library boards. It seems like some boards meet a little bit more frequently than that, but they meet six times a year. Their next meeting is in October at the Mount Healthy Library Branch, and they have been called before the county commission because the county commission meeting this week was flooded by people who are opposing this move to sell the north building or not to sell. No decision has been made about whether it should be sold or not. It's just that they're exploring what to do with it, and they've pulled the services out of it. Or they're working to pull the services out of it. So their council meeting was flooded with these people who are opposed to this decision to pull services and to potentially sell it. And the county commissioners, Todd Portoon, Denise Driehaus, and Chris Monzel all decided that they should be called. The library board needs to come and answer some questions about this project because, according to them, it was not run by the commissioners. And the commissioners, while they don't have a say over the levy, they appoint the people who are on the board. They appoint four of the members who are on the board. The other three members are appointed by Hamilton County Common Pleas judges.
In the meantime, what kind of suggestions are people making? I mean, if you don't sell it, what are some of the people who are opposed to the sale saying should be done with it?
Well, there's the potential that they could lease it. They've already kind of made the decision to pull out services. There's the children's library there. There's a homework center. There's a spot for teens. There's their new makerspace, which allows people to use 3D printers and other technology. All of those services are being pulled down into the South Building. That's just they've already made that call. Now it's a decision about what to do with it. There was a librarian who spoke at one of the last meetings of this group opposed to any kind of sale, who said that it was a lack of imagination on the board's part because if indeed the services there aren't being used, they should do something else and create a space that people will use. Other people think that it could become a branch of Cincinnati State that's been thrown out there. They've said that it could be used to offer social services and have social workers housed there for the people that use the downtown library. A lot of them need that kind of stuff. So they could be stationed there to help the people that come down to the library and need social services. But the library itself has not really floated any ideas about what could be used other than potentially leasing it or potentially selling it. And they've contracted with 3CDC to kind of explore those options. And that contract ends in December. So I would assume that 3CDC would probably have some recommendations or some options to present to the library board by the end of the year.
Now, Cameron, there's a lawsuit. City manager Harry Black is facing this, or excuse me, Evan. I mean, Cameron's in on this too, though, because I know you've both been covering this. But Evan, I wanted to have you tell us, what's this lawsuit against Harry Black about? Cincinnati police captain has filed it. Who's the captain and what's he claiming?
So that's what makes it stand out, is that this is a current, a sitting Cincinnati police captain, Jeffrey Butler. I want to say his entire career has been with the Cincinnati Police Department. So this is a guy a lot of people know. He ran the Emergency Communications Center, and that will come into play in the lawsuit as well. He ran it for, I think, about a year and then was transferred out. There's a lot of moving parts to this. At the core of it is he's alleging retaliation and that he didn't get a promotion to assistant chief of police. And that is coming from a place of his counterpart with Cincinnati Fire over when he was at the ECC, the 911 center, was an assistant fire chief. He wanted to be an assistant police chief. He never got the promotion. The allegation is it's because of retaliation from the city manager, because he was raising questions about how Homeland Security grants and tax money that is allegedly meant for the 911 center was being used in other places in the city, though, you know, in some cases, including police salaries. The other part of this that has gotten a lot of attention too.
So is it, it's misuse of funding,
I guess. Yeah, it's a misuse of public funds.
Okay, that's what the claim is.
So it's a retaliation, misuse of public funds. And then there's this, at the very end of the lawsuit, is a little section alleging that all purchasing through the city by order of the city manager has to go through a clearinghouse that is based on 9th Street across from City Hall. It, effectively a 15% upcharge for everything the city's buying. And it's run by one of Harry Black's friends from Baltimore, from his time as the chief financial officer out there. This guy, Al Fox, was the public works director at the time. What we know about Al Fox is he came here and he left Baltimore January 2014, told a publication in Baltimore, I'm going to Cincinnati to work in facilities, maintenance, and construction. It's a family member's company. And then 6-8 months later, Harry Black's hired on as the city manager. I can tell you the secretary at the company, when I went in Tuesday to try and find this guy, he hasn't worked for the company in at least a month. So that's sort of been the city manager's response is this guy doesn't own this company. He's an employee. There's no way I'm funneling this money into his pocket. So there were a lot of moving parts there. You've got
sounds
the retaliation.
Like it's pretty complicated. Yeah.
And, but the serious, what really got everyone to look up was this misuse of public funds. Did this money need to go to the 911 center? And what are we doing with purchasing?
The two things that we discovered kind of in addition to that was Harry Black issued a memo mm-hmm. late in the day when this story kind of broke, when the day the lawsuit was filed this week. And he's explained that this company that he this alleged purchasing clearinghouse that Butler mentions is a joint venture between two well-established minority-owned businesses in Cincinnati, D.E. Fox Construction and Brown Electric and Construction,
Electric,
I believe.
And the city's used them both for like a decade.
They've used them for a very long time. But what we do know is that based on state records from the auditor's office that Al Fox set up that he licensed this LLC, which is this joint venture. So we do know that portion of it. And then the other kind of the opposite side of it that we found was interesting is that we went through our archives and Captain Butler is a captain now, in part because he was part of a lawsuit to sue to get his captain's position. So that's the another kind of element of the story that has come out in our research is that there was a lawsuit. This was, I think, over 10 years right. ago. And he was part of a suit that said, you know, he was claiming I scored a group of people were saying I scored a certain amount of points on this test for promotion. You know, the first top scorers should get assistant chief's jobs, which means that they'll be moved out of their captain's positions. And because we were the next scorers down, we should get their positions as captains. The suit was very drawn out. It went on for several years. And eventually, I think it was just kind of, you know, some things were moved around and it kind of went away. But he got his captain's position after kind of diving into this litigation.
And is that what Butler's asking for in this suit, that he wants his promotion? Is that what he wants to get out
yes.
of this?
Yeah. Yeah.
And he wants, I guess his attorneys will tell you, he wants the city to stop using this money and funnel it back into the 911 center, which has had some issues. And I'll tell you, Sergeant Dan Hills with the FOP, you know, I called him Tuesday and I just wanted to know, were the rank and file satisfied with how the 911 center was being run under Captain Butler? Because there had been issues, you've got the Motorola issues with the radios, and you've got an issue of, you know, if you call down by the river, counties in Kentucky can pick you up and not be able to triangulate where you are. and they've made really good steps to fixing a lot of these issues. And Sergeant Hill said, you know, I was actually really upset when they transferred him out because he had this institutional knowledge of our problems. He said, it's not that the new guy is bad. It's just, it was like relearning. And so now you have to start over.
Starting from square one. Yeah.
Yeah, he told me the same thing. Hills told me that that he was really surprised at the transfer, and that that he felt like that Butler was a smart guy who was he said, and his quote was, he was learning a lot from him, mm-hmm. and so yeah, it was it seemed to come as a shock to the Union president.
So what's Harry Black had to say about this? Has he reacted to it?
He says it's a disgruntled employee who couldn't cut it in the process of being promoted to an assistant chief. I mean, he used disgruntled employee Tuesday afternoon.
Unhappy employee, he said. And we have, I think the several council members have called to have him come before council to answer questions about all of this at the next Law and Public Safety Committee meeting.
Budget and
Finance Committee
meeting. Charlie Winburn's
Which is not this coming Monday, but the following Monday.
I made a couple of calls today just to see. They haven't heard officially. I mean, if he's going to show up or what's going to happen, I would expect we'll know that in the next week.
Definitely.
Okay, let's close out with Oktoberfest.
Oktoberfest,
it's a Cincinnati.
Great weekend in the city of Cincinnati.
Yeah, this was what, part of the Gemütlichkeit games, I think they are? You were in a barrel race today,
Evan? I was in a barrel race right before I came over here at noon.
Describe this to us.
It was Dan Wells from Fox 19 and I. It's a beer barrel, and you have to lay it down and just kind of roll it. It was a little bit uphill, too. It's uneven. This was down at third in race. Kind of in that empty parking lot. It's a little uneven. I mean, these barrels are going everywhere, and I lost because I made it back and I turned my barrel up and I wasn't all the way over the finish line. And so Dan got in right and got it over the finish line. I'm like trying to wiggle it over, and
that is
so
tragic.
I lost.
Did they have the wiener dog race?
They did. They had the wiener dog races, I think at 11.
Okay. Do you know who won by chance?
I don't know who won. I missed that. I came down as everyone was dispersing.
I think we had a GoPro on our wiener.
And our wiener did not win.
So you know that for a fact because you had a GoPro camera on.
Her name is Minnie. And I had a wiener dog on my shirt and it really freaked her out. I went to pick
her
up and take a picture
with her. That's why you didn't do well in the barrel race then.
Probably.
But anyhow, this draw is what, 650,000 people they're expecting?
It's the largest outside Munich.
Yeah. And it runs through Sunday. And where's the exact location of this? I know they moved it because
second
of the streetcar.
Third, I think between Elm and what are the streetcar tracks? It ends at the streetcar tracks.
Walnut?
Is that Walnut?
Or Vine?
I think that's Walnut. Yeah, it comes down. So I guess between Elm and Walnut, second and third. I'll tell you, last year was the first year they had it at that location, and I was hesitant because Fifth Street's a little bit iconic. You know, but it packs people in like sardines. There's a little bit more room to breathe down on second and third and in that area.
So you're not as skeptical now about
the
location?
No, I'm all for it. Okay. It didn't change the feel of the festival at all.
But the 41st year for this, that's amazing. Great event. Runs through Sunday. And Cameron, Evan, and Bob, thanks so much for joining us this afternoon.
It's always a pleasure.
Thanks.
WCPO multimedia journalist Evan Millward, WCPO economic development reporter Bob Driehaus, and Inquirer City Hall reporter Cameron Knight. Thanks for listening to Cincinnati Edition. You can find archives of our programs at WVXU.org. The producer for today's show was Pete Reitmeier with help from Jim Nolan. Josh Elstro was the technical director. William White composed the Cincinnati Edition theme music. I'm Mark Haney.